This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Good evening. Thank you for coming tonight. We are pleased to announce the public discussion on Peter Alexander Meyer's book, Civic War and the Corruption of the Citizen. We'll have an open discussion, but let me introduce briefly the three main speakers. First, Peter Alexander Myers is professor of American Studies at the Sorbonne Nouvelle in Paris, visiting fellow in the Department of Philosophy at Princeton University, director of the Working Group on Rhetoric and Public Knowledge at NYU's Institute for Public Knowledge. Civic War and the Corruption of Citizen is the first part of a three-volume work on democracy in America after 9/11. Discussing with him tonight will be Michael Delicarpini, Dean of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of many books, Stability and Change in American Politics, The Coming of Age of the Generation of the 1960s, co-editor of Political Decision-Making, Deliberation and Participation, and also of What Americans Know About Politics and Why It Matters. The next to me, Thomas Sugru, is Edmund J. and Louise W. Kahn, professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Post-War Detroit, Sweet Land of Liberty, most recently, Sweet Land of Liberty, The Forgotten Struggle for Civil Rights in the North, co-editor of New Suburban History, and W.E.B. Du Bois, Race and the City. So I thank them for coming tonight to discuss Peter Alexander Meyer's provocative and stimulating book. But perhaps we'll begin with Peter presenting rapidly the circumstances of the writing of the book and then discussion.
Obviously, the first thing to say is thank you very much to Jean-Michel Rabaté and the Slot Foundation for hosting this opportunity to talk about the book. Thank you for coming. And thank you especially to my colleagues who generously agreed at a moment we have all identified as the most intense and preoccupying of the year to come and join and help me to understand what I've written about from some different perspectives. It's particularly interesting for me to have a chance to speak with these two very different types of scholars. Since the book is about the citizen, and I'll maybe say a word about why I put it that way, rather than talking about citizenship, but it's useful and an honor for me to be able to talk about that with Michael Delicarpini, who is someone who has studied American citizenship in one of the most interesting ways around, and Tom Sugru, who I approached out of thin air and very generously and probably not knowing what he was getting into, accepted to do this. And I, again, am looking forward to hearing his take on the book as an historian in general, because part of the project of the book is to find a way to integrate materials and perspectives familiar to historians into a project that is probably rather unfamiliar to historians. And thus it's important for me to have a dialogue, a continuing dialogue with historians to see how that works and how one might do it again in a similar or a different way. And then more specifically, since Tom Sugru also in his own way works on the question of citizenship, and particularly I had the privilege of hearing now 2 weeks ago, I guess, the first of three lectures on Obama and as history at Princeton, where he seems to be working out some themes that are actually quite close to my interests and overlapping in interesting ways that also seemed to me to make him an excellent interlocutor for this moment. Now, I'm just going to say a few words about the book itself, because one of the characteristic features of the book is that it is intended as, and at least in my notebooks and in my own thinking and in my own work, a nexus of a whole series of different types of projects that are all generally speaking about the nature of politics, or the fundamental condition, as I tend to put it, the fundamental conditions of political relationship. And to think about that is to think almost of itself in terms that are not limited to political science, as most people understand it, but necessarily relying on the means and some of the instruments of political science, and then likewise a whole set of other disciplines, the history, sociology, rhetoric, and I'll leave it there for now. As you can imagine from the title and the topic of the book, the main motivation was the event of September 11th, but the repeated event of September 11th, as that phrase became the central topos or commonplace of public discourse very rapidly and proliferated throughout American political culture over the years through the Bush administration. And I put that part of my motivation that way because part of the strategy of the book is to push very hard against one of the most prominent claims made during that period, which was that the world had changed on September 11th. Now, as a matter of straightforward and obvious fact, that's false. It has to be false. Some things changed, some things didn't, but by centering my attention on that claim, I was able to ask a series of what were at once theoretical, political, and historical questions. And the center of gravity for those questions was simply the question, so if everything changed, if you know, in the face of the claim that everything changed, what didn't? And more pointedly, more specifically, to show the continuity and to show the layers of continuity that characterize the circumstances of that claim itself, I kept asking the question, so if this is a war, when did it begin? And in the book, one of the strategies is to lay out a series of answers to that question that keep reaching back further and further and further. So in a certain sense, part of the historical operation in the book works backwards from the standard way of writing narrative history. Rather than finding a starting point and working through the threads that combine and separate and combine and separate over time and coming to whatever the end point of the book of you know, another historical study might be, I kept starting now and saying, okay, so if this was war, when did it begin? And answering that in a series of different ways. For example, on September 10th, when there were meetings about the invasion of Iraq, or at the beginning of the Bush administration, or at the so-called end of the Cold War, something I raise a lot of questions about, or at the end of the Second World War, and et cetera, et cetera. So there's all these moments of reaching back in longer and longer periods in an attempt not just to keep pushing back a single line, but to show the layering of history as it occurs in different blocks or different size blocks of time at once. Now, as a matter of method, and maybe I'll just say this and then one other thing about the project as a whole, but as a matter of method, which I could rephrase that by saying as an approach to the study of political life and the formation of political relationships, I adopt a kind of literary conceit in the book, which is this notion of the position of the citizen. And I do that because in almost all the studies of politics that I'm familiar with, and as you can imagine, since this is what I do, I'm familiar with a fair number of those, some version of what could crudely be called the theory practice question always pushes back and always interrupts, so to speak, one's reading or one's thinking or what one takes away from the text that one has encountered. So you get fantastic descriptions of historical events or accounts of empirical sociological circumstances or any range of another set of things. But the question always comes, so how do I apply this? What do I do with this? What do I make of this? And then either you're stopped short often by those studies that by their disciplinary inclination don't offer that kind of advice, or you can turn to works in a different discipline, let's say, for example, political theory, or a range of other typically moralizing kinds of texts, which present you with an account of a citizen in the abstract and say, okay, now, given that stuff that was described over there, this is what you should do. Go do A, B, C, and D. Go join this association, vote more often, do these various things. And so, as a matter of method, in this book, what I tried to do was to find a way to circumvent that problem at the beginning. Now, of course, it's going to return in various forms and at different moments, but so I took this idea of, all right, I imagine a character who I'm calling the citizen. Now, in volume two, this is going to bear on what the whole project is about. In volume two, in a more general way, I lay out what I would call the constitutive conditions of that social position. But for now, just imagine that it has to do with things that are familiar to you as citizens and the kind of things that you associate with citizen activities, just stated in a kind of reductive way so that you can actually see them as maxims or principles and so forth and so on. I'm setting that aside. In this book, I just imagine that character, and I keep asking, so what would you do? You, dear reader, this is the situation in which you find yourself. How are you going to reach out to the environment in which you find yourself? How are you going to reach out to historical materials, to institutional circumstances, to your everyday life, to the president as a symbolic figure, to the state as a whole, as something that's structuring your environment and your circumstances, and so forth and so on? And rather than, so to speak, starting at the beginning, as if I could identify the beginning of all those things at once or even singly, I just say, here you are in the middle of things. Now what are you going to do? And the book is a series of propositions in which I say, okay, well, you might want to push this way and see where you get. Or you might want to push this way and see if that helps you move yourself. And two things are consequent to that. One, for example, what I talked about first, which is this approach to history, in which I'm just pushing back because I imagine somebody, as I did myself and many of my friends did, and I should say, I very, very proudly, my copy editor, when she got the manuscript at first, read it through and wrote back to me and said, you know, for the last 5 years, I've had no idea what was happening to me and what's going on, and everything I hear sounds like bullshit. And I read your book, and I finally see what's happening to me, which is exactly the reaction that I wanted from the reader. Now, whether anybody else reads it that way, that's a whole other question. But that was my purpose, was to just invite the reader to situate him or herself in this thing that I refer to as the position of the citizen and keep pushing in those directions, which, in my view, it would have been natural for somebody, as I did myself, to keep pushing. They're saying, the world started again? Wait a minute. That can't be right. Let's think about yesterday. Let's think about last year. Let's think about my lifetime. Let's think of et cetera, et cetera. So that's where, for what I talked about at first, joins with my, so to speak, the method of the book or the approach that I tried to give. And as you can imagine, I could, well, you tell me. I mean, I can state a couple of propositions that also come up in the book, if you like, or but maybe it's better if those just come out in the discussion, because I'm sure that people will raise different kinds of themes or different outlandish claims that I make, and I'll do my best to either escape or defend myself in that process.
I think, yes, Michael and Tom can sure. Ask or to comment. I don't know which order.
Doesn't matter to me.
Yeah, Tom.
I can go. I guess I'm the historian, so I do the old stuff. I have some general notes that I've kind of written as I really grappled with what is a really profound, important, original, and challenging book. I commend it to everyone. It's really quite an extraordinary piece of work. And I come at this with a little bit of humility because I'm not a political theorist. I'm barely even a theorist. I'm a historian. And I read this book in some ways as Peter intended, as a citizen, or as the citizen. But I also read it as a historian, and I think I'll bring my historian's perspective to bear on my engagement with a book that is in some ways very deeply informed by history, and I think actually says some very important things about the relationship of history and the present, and indeed about the ways that history can inform theory. And I guess I'll begin by reflecting on the fact that most historians, especially historians of modern America, emphasize discontinuity. This in some ways is almost a starting point of kind of a given of so much historical scholarship. We, that is, the historian, to use the, mm-hmm. the singular, are attracted, I think, sometimes at great cost to our analytic powers, we're attracted to disjuncture, to rupture, or apparent rupture, or apparent turning points. This is a problem especially in the study of a recent period when, as I think in many, there's so much that's rich in this book, but there's a point at which Peter begins by discussing the relationship of the media and of television to the creation of images and the role that those images play in our understanding of the present and our different and contested pasts. And so many of us doing recent history especially go back to what we sometimes call history's first draft. We rely on the news media as our primary source or primary sources, and we fall back on mediated representations, especially those produced by television, which is a medium that by definition emphasizes the novel or that which appears to be novel and focuses intently on singular events, often at the expense of context. And we fall in the ways that we analyze our present and our past into that sometimes decontextualization that's a necessary part of the media. And I want to quote from Peter here. I've got a couple of quotes because I've seldom written up a book so much. I mean, there's so many quotes. I also could go through and just kind of assemble what I consider to be some of the choicest phrases and turn that into my account. But here's what he writes very powerfully, I think. Television is for us instrumental in making an instant into a moment, into a sequence, into a scenario, into a way of life, into an epoch. He goes on, everything appears in the public sphere in quotes because he problematizes the term, I think, quite brilliantly. Everything appears in the public sphere is immediately earth-shattering or epoch-making. And here he's writing about September 11th, the moment when the conventional wisdom goes, everything changed. But what he demonstrates so powerfully here in a way that pulls us away from the gaze of the camera and those images that we see and hear again and again is the importance of continuity. And this is where I think he offers a challenge to historians and actually speaks to my own interest as a historian. I really try to put a lot of emphasis on continuity in my own work in ways that sometimes lead me to read against the grain or challenge some of the conventional wisdom, looking at connections between past and present. And in Peter's framework, the post-9/11 moment or sequence, or epoch, to use his language, is of a piece with the unresolved past. Through ideology, through culture, through institutions, indeed even through key political players, this post-9/11 period is part of a long Cold War. And in fundamental respects, it's part of an even longer current of modernity, one that suppresses citizenship, in the American case, not necessarily through brute violence, but rather through a process of creating consent, a consent that leads, in his telling of the post 9/11 story, especially in the consolidation of monocratic power. And there are different historical processes at work that shape this this development that he describes. And it's a deeply historical framework. And I want to focus on each of these elements, two of them quickly and one of them a little more detail. The first is the expansive notion of the idea of emergency. And this, to me, was a real eye-opening section of the book and actually leads me to rethink some of what I write about and teach about. And the use of the concept of emergency as a vehicle for the extension of state power. So that's one of, I think, the really important themes that comes out of this book. The next, and it's a related point, is the proliferation in modernity, but especially in the 20th century, and especially in the modern United States, of analogies to war. From the war on unemployment to the war on poverty to the war on drugs to the war on terror. And then the third and most crucial point is the one I started with a moment ago, which is the Cold War. And all of these, in some ways, are part and parcel of a process of the blurring of the distinctions between war and peace that are really central to his framework for thinking about 9/11. So I'm going to focus just on one of these three, although we could talk about the other two, I think, at great length because they're so rich and so instructive for making sense out of this this moment or this epoch. And they're all important parts of kind of the story of continuity that he's telling. But the Cold War is where Peter's argument's the most powerful and the most original and the freshest. And it's important in part because historians and journalists and scholars writing about the Cold War have generally fallen into a framework that emphasizes discontinuity, the discontinuity, of course, being 1989. That element of discontinuity is reinforced by the moment of discontinuity that's the hinge of this book, which is the moment of 9/11, which in some ways seems to supplant the end of history, the end of the Cold War, with a new moment, a new epoch, the war against terror, which is generally discussed, if at all, in light of the Cold War, in a binaristic way, which reinforces the discontinuity of 1989 and the discontinuity of 2001, I think in ways that Peter shows us are very problematic for positioning ourselves as a citizen and making sense. So as he puts it, it's another really fabulous quote here, we are the grown children of the Cold War. And I think he means that here, both kind of in terms of where we are in history, that is, most of the citizens who are reading his book came of age in the Cold War, but more than that, I think in a really powerful kind of metaphorical way, that we live in a world where, in some ways, our politics were very much of the parentage of the Cold War. So he writes, we are the grown children of the Cold War. While most of us are not Cold Warriors, we nonetheless have Cold War habits of thought and action. Or what he calls in another part of the book, or another, actually part, a few pages later, Cold War common sense is what shapes our way of engaging with the world, including our ways of understanding 9/11 and the transformation, or not transformation, actually, of state power in the aftermath of 9/11 that builds very much on this Cold War common sense. The Cold War, in other words, is not over at all in his telling. It's a war like the war on terror that's fueled by imagination, it's laden with symbolism, and it's fundamentally rooted in fear. So you could say, in some ways, Peter's book offers us a version of the oft-quoted Randolph Byrne argument, one that maybe is quoted too much, that war is the health of the state. Instead, he argues, in some ways, looking at the continuities between the Cold War and the post 9/11 period, that war is the health of the executive, or maybe more so, war is also an illness that plagues democracy and weakens if it does not entirely kill the citizen. And so ultimately, the defining and disabling characteristic of the Cold War in its various versions is, among other things, its emphasis on moral clarity, or maybe we could call it even, and using my phrase, not his, moral certainty, in ways that put a value on consensus, on unity and uniformity, on conformity. And this ultimately, I think, is the common thread of the Cold War and the post 9/11 period, one that ultimately suppresses contentious politics, discussion among citizens. It's ultimately essential to citizenship and the maintenance of the public, or the act of publicity, which is another really important and original concept that we can talk more about in a few minutes. So I can keep going, but I think I'll kind of stop there. But I want to just sort of a couple of questions, or maybe I'll hold on my questions, and we can raise them over the course of the discussions. It's a little more of a dialogue and back and forth, because ultimately I wondered, as the citizen, not as the historian, what I should do, or what the citizen should do at the end of this book, which in some ways is left me deeply pessimistic. I am, you know, maybe to use a Gramscian quote, someone who's, you know, pessimistic of the intellect, a pessimist of the intellect and an optimist of the will. And this book very much reinforced the pessimism of my intellect and didn't necessarily infuse my will with a sense of optimism. So I wondered, you know, kind of in terms of thinking about being a citizen, being the citizen, how to engage what in some ways is a story of a weakened, atrophied, disempowered citizenship that really seems to be the one of the takeaway points from the Cold War and the post 9/11 story that he tells. I guess I'll throw this other question just to kind of get it in the air and we can stew it over. But unity, right, which doesn't come across, and consensus don't come across too favorably here, and it's everywhere in the air now, in a different valence than the immediate post 9/11 valence. And I'm wondering in some ways, that, you know, I can read into this book, and I think maybe correctly, a powerful problematization of the ways in which, in a certain way, we have, while we have a different version of executive power, a monocracy, both are fundamentally animated in some ways by a similar current. One that de-emphasizes dissensus and contention, and emphasizes consensus and unity. And I'm wondering, in some ways, if we're going to think about continuity instead of discontinuity, that all of the discussion about November 4th, 2008 being a moment of discontinuity might be one of those mediated moments of image occluding our critical thinking about ways in which, in some ways, there are certain elements of post 9/11 continuity, or that 2008 in some ways might be another chapter in the moment of 1949, the moment of 2001. A provocation. I don't know the answer. Maybe Peter has one. So thanks.
So let me jump in. And actually, it's a pretty good segue. First of all, thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to have read this book. I think Civic War and the Corruption of the Citizen is timely. It's very good. It's even an important book. And while it's set in the context of the post 9/11 America, at its heart, it's a book about the nature of democracy and the centrality of the citizen to democratic practice. And so I want to focus on that element of it. What does this tell us about the citizen and the centrality of the citizen to democracy? It's also an indictment, I think, of the state of American democracy, a state that has its roots much preceding 9/11, and the complicity, and I want to emphasize this, of the citizen in this current state of affairs. There's an interesting back and forth in Peter's book about the extent to which even he assiduously avoids and, in fact, mentions his avoidance of terms like victim. But in many ways, the citizen is in an awkward position in this book. The citizen is both the acted upon in ways that make it difficult for citizens to act as citizens, as Peter sees them. But also, there's an element in the book that is a subtext, which is, if only, that nothing that has happened prevents citizens from behaving as citizens, and that very act of behaving as citizens, the way Peter describes that, which I'll describe in a minute, would be maybe not enough, but would be the counter to the very conditions that we find ourselves in. So it makes for an interesting dilemma that I want to push on a little bit in a moment. So basically what I'd like to do is briefly summarize what I think is at the heart of Peter's argument, although I have to admit this is a very rich and complex book, and so anything I do will do violence, no pun intended, to what is a very complicated argument in a very good, rich way. But I want to get at what I took away as the heart of it. Say a word or two about what I think it adds to our understanding of citizenship and democracy, and then raise a couple of, or push Peter on a couple of concerns I have about what some of the absences in what's in here might mean if you read this in its totality, though I know there are two other volumes that are coming. So a very simple summary of the argument, and it has multiple parts to it. But basically what's being argued here is that politics, or the public interest, or the public part of the world that we live in, has an essentially contested nature to it. These are my words, not Peter's, and I'm making them stark, and therefore, as I said, not doing justice to them, but that there is a socially constructed nature to public life, and that politics is at heart a process by which the meaning of public life is constructed, renewed. The public sphere, though it's a complex and debatable term, is where this process takes place. And that citizens have, and this is my term again, abdicated, though they have been encouraged to do so, their role as citizen, but that they are still able to speak publicly, and it's the act of speaking publicly that is at the heart of democracy. There is a kind of, and again, I'm simplifying, an emperor's new clothes aspect to this argument, which is if only people stood up when something was going on that was counter to common sense, public judgment, your own sense of what's going on as an individual citizen, that act of speaking publicly as a citizen, and doing it not just in public spaces that we normally think about through elections and town hall meetings, but in everyday life, standing up and speaking publicly about public issues, that's what makes democracy operate, that the very design of democracy in the United States, the very design of the Constitution, is not to make that go away, but actually make that happen, and it depends on that. And what has happened over at least the last half a century, maybe longer, though Peter focuses heavily on the Cold War period, is if not conscious, a systematic set of events that has redefined what democracy means and used war as a central trope of redefining it in a way that makes it less likely that citizens will do that and therefore move us away from the very essence of what democracy is. I think, again, it's much more complex and rich than that, but that is in many ways what's at the heart of this. The specific argument that's being made, and I'll just take this from the jacket of the book, although it's expressed in much more detail throughout the book, is that the trope of war and 9/11 as a immediate, most immediate example of the use of that term war, there is a dialectic that takes place, that shock incites terror. And these are his words: terror invites war, war invites emergency, though he's very careful and I think correct in making clear that emergency often precede war, but that war invokes emergency, and emergency supports unchecked power, which leads to a move from democracy or a transition, he doesn't want to call monocracy a separate form of government, but leads to monocratic elements within our own democracy. And that's been happening relatively systematically, at least since the Cold War, and 9/11 is simply, using simply in quotes, a new use of the term war that has its roots in this longer period that has long preceded the 9/11 period as well. That's a very important argument, and it's what makes it important as well is the notion that that politics and democracy is essentially a discursive form of government. That it is through discourse and who gets to shape that discourse that democracy operates successfully or not so successfully. Again, the argument is much more complex than that. It has a lot to say about the Cold War and about the post 9/11 period. It makes very important insights about the notion of the plurality of citizenship, that there is, even though he talks about the citizen, that citizenship itself, that we are all different citizens in many ways, and in the end, it politics and events of the public world pass through us as individuals. Hence Peter's notion at the beginning that he wanted to write this book in a way that how do I, as a citizen, react to the events that are going on around us. It has tremendous things to say about the importance of speaking out and the role of publicity. It's a very interesting use of that term in democracy, the idea that it is through publicity, through the making things public, that democracy operates. So as I said, it's a very rich discussion. But at its heart, I think, even though Peter does not use these terms, is this notion that in many ways public life is socially constructed, that there is no single right or wrong answer to things, and that it's through the process of public dialogue and public speaking out in a variety of settings that what we mean by what is good, what is right, what is appropriate is, and it's through the conflict and discussion of those things that that politics really plays out and the public good plays out, though he never uses the word public good. So what does this add to our understanding of the citizen and citizenship and democracy? Well, first of all, I think it places 9/11 in a tremendous context in a way that's really important. And you cannot understand 9/11, I think a lot of us around here would agree with this, simply as an event that took place and has a very singularly articulated beginning and that the world has changed afterwards, that it has deep roots. That whether you trace those roots into our relationship with the Middle East or trace it through the Cold War or trace it through the constant struggle for who gets to speak for democracy, that it has very deep roots that makes it seem much more continuous with the past than separate from the past. There's a whole theme through this book that is in some ways a subtext to the larger issue of democracy, but is the whole notion of what we mean by war. What is war? Why do we have war? What is the premise of war? How do we define war? That I think is a really important contribution, and we could talk about that. The recentering of the citizen in democracy is an important component of this, at the same time that it continuously makes clear that there is no single citizen, that we are citizens in groups and ultimately as individuals. As I mentioned in a somewhat different way, one of the contributions is the notion of the public, discursive, or communicative, constructed, and contested nature of politics, that politics is ubiquitous, that it doesn't simply reside in the institutions of the state, and that the media plays an important role in the way in which we come to think about politics. The complicity, and I'll use that term again, of citizens in their own marginalization is a theme that's really important here, and I want to push a little bit on in a minute. But the intersection of this complicity with the structure of the state, with elites and the media. So it is not a blaming the victim kind of argument, and yet it skirts that, I think, in some places, and I want to talk about that. And also, it has a lot to say about the limits of the Constitution and of constitutionalism as the kind of checks that one might hope it puts in place on the ability of a democracy to have a monocratic tendency. And that one of the central arguments, I think, of Peter's book is that if we want to count on the design and structure of the Constitution to keep us on an even keel and prevent us from moving too far afield from some notion of democracy, think again. Because within a constitutional democracy, you can move, these are my words again, just as easily towards monocratic tendencies as you might in a less democratic or non-democratic kind of state. So I think those are all really important, rich contributions that we can discuss. But I want to suggest that there are some things that troubled me about the book, not because they weren't there, but because in their final emphasis they were downplayed in ways that I think need to be foregrounded again. So one is, Peter goes to a lot of trouble to downplay the that structure is a determinant of process. And so he wants to argue, I think, that to think about structural aspects of the state, the separation of powers, executive power, the emergency powers, the way the courts have made decisions about what is or is not allowable, the relationship, the to and fro between Congress and the executive branch, that's not where, in the end, real issues of agency and authority and democracy reside, though they're important to it. I think that's right as a antidote to people thinking that structures are too important. But in downplaying the importance of structure, I think we can move too far in the other direction, and I'll explain in a minute what I mean by that. Because part of this is what I read as something of a downplaying of the importance of the state. And ultimately, I worry that the beautiful metaphor of people in a theater and one person standing up, and that person then is the center of attention. But if everyone stands up, that person is no longer the center of attention, and that what's missing in American democracy today is the rest of us standing up. That's great, but standing up alone, at what point does standing up alone really have the power that you give it? And at what point is it that you can stand up? In fact, I want to make the case people did stand up after 9/11 at some level, and yet without the power that comes from being part of the apparatus of the state, or with the power of the apparatus of the state working against you, that in and of itself may not be enough. And I know Peter knows that from just reading the book, but the tendency in the direction that the book moves is to move away from the state as being the focus of the book. And as a result, I think it both gives citizens too much and not enough power, is the point I want to make. Mm-hmm. Too much power in the sense that I'm not sure that standing up under certain conditions is enough. Not enough power in the sense that in many ways, in part because of the trope that Peter uses of saying 9/11 happens, what does that mean for me as a citizen? That makes the power of the citizen reactive. So in a sense, what the book is about is, because I don't have this other power, because I am the subject of the way the media presents 9/11 to me, because I am affected by, I can only listen to the discourse, the consensual discourse of a presidency, an executive branch, and even a Congress that spoke in a single voice that did not resonate with me, my only power is to say, wait a minute, I have to be skeptical of that. I have to question that. Now, that's a lot of power, and not enough people did that, I think. But in the end, is that really at the heart of what makes democracy operate? Is it enough? So that's what I mean by not enough and too much at the same time. It's a kind of reactive power in some ways. It also, as I read the book, here are some of the other worries that emerge. Is it an overly individualistic notion of politics? That in being willing to say that each of us ultimately are the creators, if we're playing our role as citizen, of what politics means and how we interpret it, and standing up and saying that, can it move to such an... Does it move from the importance of pluralism to a kind of individualistic notion of politics that works to the opposite of what Tom mentioned? When does consensus operate in different ways that might be more valuable? I mentioned that Peter was very careful not to blame the victim, but there is an element of this at times that sounds as if it's saying if citizens would only just stand up, that they still have the power to do that, that if they would only just do that, we would be, have resolved this problem, but that there is a certain amount of agency that's still left with the citizen and therefore responsibility that seems more individualistic than I might put it. Peter does a great job problematizing the notion of the public sphere and public spheres, but there are multiple public spheres going on as a result of that. And there is a debate, a discourse that goes on with Congress, there is a discourse that goes on in the media, and there is a discourse that goes on among the public. And talking more about how those three might intersect, I think, would be of value. I think that Peter does a great job interrogating a lot of terms that we take for granted. One term that is not interrogated enough is terror and terrorism, I think, he's almost forced to do this in trying to explain how the post 9/11 period is really implicated in a much longer history. There is a certain level of taking the terrorist attacks themselves as an accepted fact. I mean, obviously those terrorist attacks took place, but there is less interrogation of the notion of these being terrorist attacks and this being a period of terrorism than I think you do a much better job interrogating the other terms than you do that, and I think that might complicate in some good ways your argument. And then I want to say a couple of words about is the description of what happened post 9/11 accurate? So the assumption, not a lot of time is spent on this, but the assumption is that because of its connection to a priming that took place in the Cold War period, that in the post 9/11 period, citizens either sat silently, like the person that Peter mentioned that he talked to, the copy editor, I guess it was, who said, "I never felt like this is what was going on. It didn't resonate with me, but I never said anything, and thank God I'm finally reading something that tells me what this means." That's one reaction. And the other reaction is maybe to, not in their silence, in their standing up, buy into this notion that this is what's going on. But is that all that happened? I'm not sure that's all that happened. If you look at the build-up to the Iraq War in the post-9/11 period, and here I'll be a political scientist who does use what I would immediately admit are really crude kind of measures of what the public is about. But if you look at public opinion surveys in that period, it's not clear people were buying into it, nor that they weren't speaking out about it. There were a large number of protests. The internet was filled with at least a subterranean questioning of what was going on. The public opinion surveys that I just mentioned showed that the public wanted, if we were going to even consider going into Iraq, wanted it to be with more evidence of weapons of mass destruction and with more international support. So there was at least a little bit of the standing up in the theater that Peter longs for, and yet it didn't have the effects that I think we would hope. Now, maybe that's simply a matter of not enough. Maybe it's simply a matter of the predominant discourse kind of drowning out that. I think it's the state and the media that allowed that to happen. That the state was able, partly because of the things Peter talked about, because of the long history of the Cold War, was able to say, I can remember Condoleezza Rice saying this after there was a series of protests that took place. Isn't it great that we live in a democracy where people can protest? Mm-hmm. Isn't it great that we live in a democracy? You can't do that in Iraq. You can't do that in Iran. You can't do that in the axis of evil. People can speak their mind. And yet the unstated next sentence was, but we're not going to pay any attention to it. And so the question is, if the state is in a situation to not need to pay attention to the publicness of what the public feels, the standing up in the theater, the state may be more powerful in all this than at least the reading I took away from the book. Similarly, with the media, Tom read some great quotes about a very interesting part of the book that talks about the importance of the media and its representation of 9/11. And yet, in the rest of the book, the media kind of begins to disappear in many ways. And I think that that what I took away from the book that brings the state and the media and communication back into this is that who gets to speak first really can start a shaping, if things don't work the way they're supposed to, of what discourse is about. So if you get to define 9/11 as a war, that puts into play a kind of self-reinforcing process. So where you start in public discourse is really important, and whether that starting point becomes the only major voice is really important. I think the media plays, just as the state and elites play an important role in what that starting point is, the media plays an important role in that, and is really complicitous in ways that I think could be developed more in the corruption of the citizen that Peter is describing in here. So I think the notion of a discursive notion of democracy is crucial. But there are other authors who I found myself thinking about that, as near as I can find, were not brought into this discussion that I think could be part of this discussion. And I think it's a good way for other people in the room who may know these other authors to think about the way in which, at least my interpretation of what Peter is doing. So William Connolly and the work that he used by Galley, I think, is really important. What Peter is describing, I think, is that politics is essentially contested. And the terms that we use is that if you want politics to work, there's no coming to a conclusion. There's no right and wrong answer. We have to constantly be contesting what we think we mean by things. And that really resonated with me in a lot of what William Connolly has to say about these issues. And I think there's an element of Peter's work that resonates with that. Murray Adelman, for those of you who know his work, the whole notion of the symbolic uses of politics, that his notions in some of his later work that if you want to be a citizen, the best thing you can do is drop out. He really makes this argument in his later work where he says, if you try to get involved in politics, you are inevitably going to be caught up in the apparatus of the state, and you will be used. So if you really want to be a good citizen, given, you know, in a way that is very reminiscent of Peter's use of these terms, you know, he starts from the notion that, well, what do I do if I'm a citizen and 9/11 happens? Well, Edelman's answer to that, although he wrote prior to 9/11, was stay away from it. You know, that you're going to be used if you wind up getting involved. And Peter doesn't want to say that. He says stand up. But the flip side of that is maybe don't stand up, don't get involved at all, because you're going to ultimately be used. And I think some of the standing up runs the risk of being used as a citizen. If the apparatus of the state is not designed, if the public sphere is not designed in a way to encourage discourse, I think that you can go in the wrong direction. The work of Chomsky and Bagdikian and McChesney about the centralization of the media and the way in which it becomes a propagandizing tool, I think, is really relevant to what Peter is arguing. The work of Dan Hallen and his notion of the spheres of consensus and disagreement, I think part of what Peter is arguing is that too many things have moved into a kind of unthinking consensus where we don't question. That's very much what Hallen, I think, is arguing about the Vietnam War and the post-Vietnam War period. Amy Gutman, the president of Penn's work on deliberation, what are the elements of deliberative democracy, or at least democratic deliberation? I think that resonates with in at least tangential ways with what Peter is writing about. And I would suggest the early work of Noel Neumann and the whole notion of the spiral of silence, because part of what Peter's describing, I think, is how a spiral of silence can develop. So I think all these are really important tentacles to what Peter is arguing, and I think those authors, which come out of communication and political science, and maybe I'm wearing my communication scholar hat now, that there's a lot in the communication literature, I think, that speaks to what you're writing that I didn't see in here that I think would, that your work would fit really nicely with and take on in some really interesting ways. So again, let me end where I started. I think this is a really rich, really powerful book, a really important book. But I also think that there are some, it raises as many interesting questions as it answers, and I hope to put some of those questions on the table. So.
At a loss for words here. Again, obviously, the first thing to say is thank you both for exceedingly generous readings of the book and a clear engagement with many of the things that are in there in quite different ways, but converging, I think, in ways that converge around the things that I think are actually the most important and at the center of my motivations for writing the book in the first place. So, thank you. I'm not totally sure how to proceed from here, because I could, if there's an inventory of 50 topics that have just been raised between the two of you, I could just say, let's see, yes, no, maybe, yes, no, I can't remember, 14, or something like that. But so I think I'm just going to come into it in a kind of ad hoc way. And the classic difficulty of the author with dead brain cells will lead me to start with the last thing that you said. of the authors that you mentioned who are absent from the discussion in the book, I should say my editor, of course, would be here sharpening his knife.
Yes.
Because there's about, I think, a third of the book is footnotes and bibliography and so forth and so on. But that aside,
More importantly, Peter, maybe as a way of shaping the question is I mentioned those authors, which I'm sure you're familiar with. What would be interesting is if you said, well, no, either yes or no, that they actually are engaged in the same general direction you're moving in, or how do you see yourself different from what?
That's what I'm going to do. Yeah. With I'm just going to take one of them.
Yeah.
And not even really address Murray Edelman, but who certainly is one of the authors in political science who introduced the dimension of the symbolic into the study of politics in a very interesting and important way. I guess starting actually in the 40s, right? Or
at least 50s, yeah.
Yeah. But and here's what I'm going to say in response to the specific element from Edelman that you introduced. Paraphrasing him, you said you're going to get used if you get involved.
Right.
And my response to that, which leads into actually a very fundamental element in my argument, and one which you raised some questions about in a different way and from a slightly different angle, is I would continue that sentence to say, and if you drop out, you're going to get used. And that's the key thing here. And it's not just I'm not simply saying that you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And I'm not simply saying that the bastards are going to get you no matter what happens. What it links back to is an argument about the nature of power, its relationship to democracy, its relationship to the Constitution, and then specifically with respect to some of the things that you were pointing to, the character of the state and the way in which the state operates in the political culture as a whole. Notice that I said operates in the political culture as a whole, because it is in political science and in a range of different perspectives, it's typical to speak of the state as if it were an entity separate from the political culture or separate from civil society. There's a long tradition of organizing one's thinking about political life by making those very sharp, categorical, and huge distinctions. But I actually think that that's a mistaken way to understand the state. And I'm going to just say a few words about that, because it constitutes the starting point for my response to or engagement with your concern about the presence or absence or the understatement of the role of the state in this argument. And to be really kind of crude about it, I just describe in a certain sense features of my view of politics. So I don't think that these kinds of, for now I'm going to call them individual moments or individual relationships, but I'm going to come back to that because there's a whole other issue there. But I don't think that these moments are separate from institutions, or in the terms in which you began your but section,
right.
That the question of structure and agency is one of the huge gaps in political science and sociology that was thematized 20 years ago in a very strong way, and then it was kind of dropped because nobody could really figure out how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Now, to be blunt about it, but I won't bore you with this, I actually have a way to deal with it, and I think I'm the only person who does. But that's a very long story. And there's a strong historical element to that as well. But here's how it works in this instance. And that is that the state it's not that the state either is or isn't the locus of political life. So, you know, there's a long tradition of saying, oh, politics, that's about the state. Then there's a long tradition of saying, oh, well, what about civil society? That's where politics really happens. And my position is more schematically speaking along the following line. When you look at civil society, you see the way in which people form certain kinds of relationships that I think can be identified as specifically political. And once you do that and you abstract it from the everyday life of civil society or the associations that characterize civil society, then you begin to see, oh, wait a minute, but those relationships also form within the institutions of the state. And so the way to think about the state and its relation to the political is to say, well, like all sorts of things that people do in life, there are these institutions, there are fixed practices, there are physical spaces where stuff happens, there's everyday habits and so forth and so on. But inside this, threaded through this, there are moments where political relationships I'm bracketing what actually constitutes a political relationship, but imagine that we have a nice kind of relatively clear-cut way of saying what the specificity of that is, that inside the state there are these moments where these relationships emerge, have a certain duration, produce certain effects, and then die out, and people fall back into their habits, or, you know, the everyday bureaucratic routine continues, just as in the church the everyday bureaucratic routine continues, or in the school, or in any other association of civil society. So the issue is not to decide, is politics really in civil society or in the state, but rather to identify that specific difference of a certain way of engaging with others and being. And this is where I'm looking individualist, and I said a moment I'm going to come back to this to show why it's not. But this looks like an individualistic argument about that, because it identifies these kind of transitory moments, and, or you could say elements of networks where certain things converge, and I want to call those the political moments. Now, that doesn't exactly respond to the way in which you raised the question of the absence of the state. But what it does, I think, is to give us a tool for posing your question in a different way, which is in the background of what I'm doing. Because obviously, you know, we work in similar areas, and the question of the state is pretty important for me, too. And, you know, especially during the Bush administration, you'd be kind of an idiot if you thought that actually nothing happened in the state, because the whole... That's the game here, right? I mean, the state mobilized a very large number of people and a very large number of weapons and went on an expedition and invaded a country and killed a whole lot of people. So I'm with you there. We don't want to set that aside. But again, if I think, and this is, you know, one of those moments where we say this would be a longer discussion. But it would be a longer discussion to work out in detail why I think what I just said helps us to reinterpret the function of the state in these citizen relationships. I don't know if that'll satisfy you or not, but let me move to the individualism part, because, as I said, the way I just said that probably confirms for you collectively the accusation that I'm too much of a methodological individualist. In other words, that I tend to give an account of whatever's going on in terms of what each person is doing. And there are two ways in which I want to suggest that that's not actually true. The first is this category of the citizen itself. Now, remember when I started, I said, you know, I think of this as a kind of role that people can assume, and I actually think that there are ways to talk about fundamental constitutive features. By constitutive here, I mean the way people talk about chess as being constituted by rules. If you didn't have the rule that the knight can do this and the bishop can do that, the game of chess wouldn't exist. And so I think of the position of the citizen in those constitutive terms, that there are things you can say about that kind of, the kind of relationship that this character called the citizen forms with other characters of the same type, and that those constraints create, so to speak, a kind of game in which we do whatever it is that citizens do. And you can step into that role, you can step out of that role, and that's kind of, again, the premise of the book is, gee, you know, I'm suggesting to the reader and to my fellow citizens, well, you know, it might be useful to kind of invest yourself a little more in that, because those constitutive features actually function as facilitations and constraints of the uses of your own energy by other people, such that maybe some of this stuff would happen differently if you did that. Now, so that notion of social role, and I appreciate very much that you shifted back and forth between the citizen with a capital C, this abstract thing, and citizens, meaning natural people who actually try to live or operate through those constraints and act in ways that are facilitated by the choice to act within that game. So that's one way in which I don't think actually it's my position is methodologically individualist. But even more importantly and foundationally, so to speak, really at the bottom of my thinking, is something that's spelled out in Volume 2, and of course you can read that when it comes out. it is spelled out in Volume 2, but it also appears as a kind of code throughout this whole book. And the caption for that code is what I refer to as the division of action. Now, this is kind of on the model of the notion of the division of labor. And so the idea that we industrial societies create institutions in which tasks are segmented, handed out to different people, coordinated in a way that produces a larger, something different and typically larger than what an individual could produce. And by analogy to that, I argue in the second volume, but I exemplify in this volume the idea that all action, not just making, but all action is divided, and that no human being acts by themselves. Now, there's a variety of ways to describe this, but my image for understanding this and the way in which I try to articulate it is to say every action occurs in a field of dependence. Now, a lot of people would call this interdependence, but actually, since dependence by itself is always inter, it's just pleonastic to say call it interdependence, and that's a euphemistic way of siphoning off the good dependence from the bad dependence. Whereas the fact of the fundamental human fact is that we are dependent, and that we live in this field of dependence, and that because of that fact, every action, no matter how much it looks like it's the property or something that is generated by an individual person, that's just false. There's a whole discursive, historically constructed apparatus for locating, cutting out those things, those effects, those motions from the field of dependence. But the fact is that nobody acts by themselves, because we wouldn't produce anything. It would be impossible to do anything without the presence and the cooperation of other people, or the resistance of other people. Something there, just the linkage. The fabric of society is a field of dependence, and action is always within that field. It's an inflection of, or movement, or a shaking of that field, or nudging it this way or that way. And so, in, for example, even the idea of standing up, all of that is implicated already. Now, whether it's enough, and whether there isn't still the kind of emperor's new clothes element or an insufficient collective action, you know, resolution of collective action problems or this kind of thing, for me is a slightly different issue, but I just wanted to put on the table that there's this fundamental commitment to the idea that human beings are extended in space, and that in order to act, that extension is fundamental, and it always involves our connections or interweaving with other people, and that that's where the whole game takes place. Mm-hmm. Now, one more thing on this, I'll just go to the Constitution for the moment. The separation of powers in the Constitution is, in my view, a kind of articulation or a reduction or a redirection of that fundamental fact about action. And so part of the genius of that, what historically has been called a Republican idea, or the idea that emerges in its modern form in the middle of the 18th century about dividing powers and constituting interests for each of those powers such that they're in conflict and such that they regulate or balance or check one another. That the genius of that is that it actually expresses this basic fact about political life, which is the division of action. So there's a mapping of two different levels of analysis there, and that's what underpins what is essentially a theory of the Constitution and of constitutional government as a type of political culture in the book. I could keep going on that, but I want to
follow up with a somewhat related question that goes to a common point that that both Michael and I raised, which was your discussion of the citizen and complicity. And as I went through, there's a passage, I actually flagged it with a bookmark, that I think in some ways encapsulates this framework. And you write, "The tragic fact of our responsibility for democracy is that everything goes, either because we, in our unbounded perversity or ignorance, want it, or because we do not expend the energy to stop it. And this in some ways gets to the core, and complicity is a term that shows up at various points. It's a key word in your text. And so I want to talk a little bit more about that, getting really in some ways to the core of Michael's, it's asking too much or not enough, or you know, that place that the citizen occupies in your framework for thinking about 9/11 in particular.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I respond directly to the way in which you just put that, my inclination is to say something like this: not enough or too much. That. And in a sense, I mean, this bears on your comment about the feeling that you had at the end of the book, because the book ends in a perhaps overly dramatic way, with a kind of screaming thing, and because it was still in the middle of the Bush administration, and I was, you know, really pissed off and all of that kind of stuff. But in any case, I don't think that the citizen or American citizens can be understood as victims of a dictatorial cabal. I don't think that citizens can be understood as heroes either, and that the whatever powers citizens have, and I'm not even sure that citizens have powers, and I'm not even sure that the president has powers, but what each of these different social types have is a position in which they find themselves. They're thrown into given circumstances in this weave of all kinds of stuff, which I described in a very abstract and kind of foundational way a moment ago. But in everyday life, you know, you would describe it in terms of, well, he knows him and he knows that, and this one is employed by that one, and the rules were made by Congress to do this, and our church has certain doctrines. And, you know, so there's all sorts of, all those weavings have all sorts of different names and different circumstances and locations and so forth and so on. And whatever power is, it's something that's happening in that whole fabric network of stuff. Now, citizens can't do a whole lot in that. And so I'm not going to say that by standing up, it's going to be like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, or something like that, that all of a sudden, aha, the world changes because somebody stood up. Although I should say in parentheses, the astounding thing about Barack Obama is that actually something like that happened. And, I mean, that the election of Barack Obama is a moment of almost unparalleled political genius in the American system. Now, what it means or what it's going to do for us, you know, as you raised the question of, so, you know, but aren't there these continuities across November 4th, 2008 as well? And I'm absolutely with you on that. And for a long time, I sort of rejected the idea that Barack Obama was actually going to transform anything. That alternated, of course, with moments when I think that I wanted to kill the University of Chicago for not getting my book out a year before the election, as they were supposed to have done. But anyway, I just want to resist the idea that whatever the citizen can do is going to be a heroic moment. And so in that thing of, I don't give the citizen enough and I give the citizen too much, that's exactly what I want to do. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I want to do, because that's how it is. There are these moments where the citizen has what looks like, and what retrospectively one can narrate as, phenomenal power, phenomenal effect. But you trace that out, and it's like water in your hands. It disappears. You can't identify it as a capacity or a resource or all those things that are typically used to identify power. And just in the same way, there are moments where the citizen can only blow his nose or nudge his neighbor or mow his lawn or whatever it is that he or she actually can do. And the effect that that produces in this whole fabric of society is, you know, typically you can't predict it. It's not going to align with your intentions. Forget about making a plan and achieving an end in politics as a whole. There are moments when somebody or some group or something, they can actually get from A to B. Typically the route, you know, they thought they were going to go like this, and the route to get to B is like this all over the map, and somehow mysteriously and with a huge amount of luck and sweat and effort and screaming and love, it ends up there anyway. But it's not because they pointed their little arrow and it hit the mark. So that's the kind of image of how society works that's in the background of all of this that leads me to say, or to express a view that I think you both properly characterize as too much and too little. And I don't know what else I could say about that.
I think we thank you very much. We still have something like 15 minutes, and perhaps it would be a good moment to open to questions from the audience if you feel like asking anything.
I'm a certifiable baby boomer, right? I did go to school at Kent State. I went to school at Ohio University, close by, and I think yesterday was the anniversary of Kent State. Right. So from maybe about 1967 to 72, 66, 72 or so, I think I heard there was some lost names there. But the word war and war as an issue was generative, emotive, explosive. So I'm interested in how you, I haven't read the book, so I'm interested in how you characterize that relation to the larger schematic notion of war as both an activist, rhetorical, social, political, musicated, poetic kind of terminology or so, and whether that period, all that falls into this schematic of not enough or too much, like given how it was articulated or so. And it in fact is an object lesson that we gain from that one way or another, in terms of, and I think all three of you probably can speak to this in some way or another, but particularly in the, not that there wasn't overt conceptualization of citizenship within that period, except it might have been an emergent one in the collectivity provoked by the Vietnam and civil rights movements and also the very 60-ish sensibilities that operated. So my question is, how did you treat that period within this larger Cold War framework, and how would we characterize that and deal with it one way or another?
Should I just go ahead on that?
Yep.
What Tom mentioned, some of this, and I'm sorry I didn't really get a chance to respond more directly to some of your comments, but I do a, first of all, the title of the book, Civic War, is meant to identify the fact that in the United States, in the course of the 20th century particularly, the citizens, again, taking my perspective, right, the position of the citizen as the optic for looking at all of these things, that from that perspective, from the position of the citizen, combat and the battlefield and what the United States Army now calls war fighting plays no role in the experience of most citizens in the United States. And that whatever, today, We are at war in Iraq. We are at war in Afghanistan. So this is what war looks like for the American citizen. We're sitting right here, and we're at war. Now, that's a difficult fact to come to grips with and to articulate in a way that makes any sense to anybody. But that's what I attempt to do with this notion of civic war and developing it in that way. Now, having said that, I argue that the Cold War is actually, in a certain sense, the paradigmatic case of civic war, because everybody acknowledges that it wasn't really about people shooting at each other. I mean, of course, in brackets, that's not true either, but nonetheless, that's how everybody understands Cold War, and so it's both convenient and historically correct to think of civic war as modeled by or manifest in an especially clear way in the Cold War. So it's within that frame that I think about the 60s. And in passing, and I hope at some point I'll get some pointed feedback from his contemporary historians, nudge, about my reperiodization of the Cold War, which I can't quite do for you on off the top of my head. But roughly speaking, I argue that there's this first period from Hiroshima and Nagasaki to the 1949, or it overlaps a little bit, but there's a period up until the Soviet bomb, and that the stakes for American political culture and for the management of fear as a political operation change completely when the United States, loses its monopoly on nuclear weapons. That was the huge shock, and I actually try to draw an analogy between September 11th itself and that day in September of 1949 when the New York Times announced that the Soviet Union had an atomic weapon. And everybody went crazy because that contradicted any image of the omnipotence of the United States and the idea that we were free, we ourselves could be free from the fear associated with nuclear weapons. Then there are other periods in there having to do with the rise of civil defense, Civil Defense Administration, and so forth and so on, and the organization of society around that question of managing fear. But then it's just within this framework. The 60s, for me, is, I characterize it perversely by saying that the 60s was this reactive moment. So identify the 60s as reactionary, and specifically reactionary against a decade in which people were constrained, or first they were terrorized, and they were constrained by the management of fear by the state. And that played a huge role in this explosion of activity, sorry for the verb there, but in the 60s. And that, so there was, again, rather than seeing it as a progressive moment, I saw it as, I try to identify it as defined by the period that comes before it in a specific, along a specific line. And that then that's followed more or less by Reaganism. And that Reagan restarts the Cold War. And that the characteristic feature of the guy who was supposed to have ended the Cold War was actually that he refounded it on a new ground. And the ground on which he founded it was the reaction against the 60s, not seen as the kind of reactive moment that I am pointing to, but rather as the moment in which the inherent agony and disorder and anti-traditionalism and chaos of democracy burst out. And that what happens is that Reagan refounds the Cold War as the culture war. So I make an identification of the Cold War and the culture war as well. And I don't think it's coincidental, I say this in the book, that on the day, more or less, give or take a few months, the day that the Cold War became obsolete because it had been propagandized as something that we had against the Soviet Union, when, brackets, in my view, it was actually part of the domestic political, it was an essential part of domestic political culture, and that from the citizen's point of view, it was experienced as domestic political culture, and that from the citizen's point of view, you better understand it as that and not something about something that's going on in the Soviet Union, because if your attention is over there, then people can do whatever the hell they want over here. Close the bracket. So on that day that the Soviet Union dissolved and there was no longer the public justification for the Cold War, James Hunter Davis's book called The Culture Wars appeared and provided another name for exactly the same thing that had been going on in the so-called anti-communist and, I'll leave it that, in the anti-communist push against the threat to the American way of life that had characterized the political culture of the Cold War up to that moment. So the name changed, but the game stayed the same. And Reagan, that's the sense in which he refounded the Cold War. He constituted it as the culture war, again, by using the Soviet Union to... And now we get into questions about Reagan's policies and so forth and so on. I won't do that, but I'll just say, and the George W. Bush refounds Reaganism. And in refounding Reaganism, he refounds the Cold War yet again. So another period of the... So there's a period, there's that reactive 60s, there's the age of Reagan, which Sean Wilentz would identify as starting with Reagan's election, and I would identify as starting in 1949, when Reagan is still the director of SAG and blah, 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 and all that kind of stuff. But then there's this period of the Cold War called, that starts in 1989, called the end of the Cold War, in which all those same operations and all that same conflict in the American political culture in the form of culture wars continue, but under this guise of, oh, well, the Cold War is over. But it's the same game. And then George W. Bush, on September 11th, and actually a little before that, manages to restart that whole thing. And, I mean, two quotes, my favorite quotes in this book are Irving Kristol, who writes, whatever happened on 19... Irving Kristol, the founder of the godfather of neoconservatism in the United States, and actually one of the best friends of my uncle, and it's Marvin Meyer is my uncle, and et cetera, et cetera, says, okay, you know, that's nice, 1989, the Soviet Union. This, he's speaking in 1991. That's all just well and good, but my Cold War didn't end in 1989. In fact, it intensified, because now we really get to the point, and the point is liberalism, democracy, chaos, disorder, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all the things that you are infusing the image of the civil rights movement with, by drawing that distinction between, I mean, I'm extrapolating from the first lecture. I may be completely wrong about the later lectures, but that in getting back to what has been sheared out of the image of the civil rights movement by making it a matter of mobilization rather than a matter of community organizing, and all of the things that go, the deep contested political facts that go with that, that's what pissed those guys off. That's what neoconservatism is against. That's what the Bush administration was against. They hate democracy. And that's what the Cold War was about. It's about the hatred, the fear, and the hatred of democracy, mm-hmm. And that's where that's the conflict I'm trying to get at. Now, that's a weird answer to your question, but I hope it puts it in some frame.
I don't want to just going back quickly.
Yeah. Sorry.
In terms of the quality, is there a qualitative difference in terms of the type of discourses in any given period, not isolated the 60s, for which the idea of citizenship to which you, or the idea of the construction of a sense of citizenship to which you aspire, has a apex, you know, that or that we could regard as a model, or even draw out of, you know, in terms of a larger structure. And I'm again trying to suggest that I think at least the quantity in the 60s. An investigation of the trope of war and the conditions of war, the actualities of war, the imagery of war,
right,
was quantifiable to the present. Okay. Especially also, I think, for those of us who are boomers, whose fathers were World War II veterans, so there was that kind of going back, you know, watching from the British. But I wonder, outside of that small period, I mean, is there a kind of qualitative modeling?
Very briefly, an anecdote and a response. The anecdote is that I actually just learned in the last few weeks that when my father was in the American Army in 1946 and was running an Army servicemen's traveling theater group in Japan, that he visited Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which totally blew me away, because he he saw the results of the use of those weapons. But thinking of our fathers and so forth and so on, but the answer to your question is going to sound completely perverse and offensive, especially to my historian colleague and maybe to everybody in the room. So I'll just prepare to beat a hasty retreat when I say this. But I actually think that when I talk about the parameters or the constitutive elements of the citizen, I think that they are universal in a kind of specifically historical way, and that they appear with the rise of cities in human civilization, and that they are elements that can be... I mean, it's not by chance that we call politics politics. It has to do with this. It's kind of relationship that appears in cities. Cities change over time and so forth and so on, but they evince certain characteristics in relationships amongst people, or better, they constitute certain kinds of possibilities for relationships amongst people. And so the qualitative features of my ideal model of the citizen start with an analysis of those kinds of city-like relationships. And I want to be able to give a strong foundational criterion by which citizens and other people can measure the possibilities of using civic relationships here and now that avoid all sorts of partisan, other sorts of partisan political elements at the starting point, so that we have such, because if you can't say what a political relationship is and why it's different from other kinds of relationships, and you can't say why it's a value, why it would be interesting to have that kind of relationship, then you can't really give a criticism of bad uses of those relationships. You can't say why George Bush is bad for democratic citizenship or for democracy at all.
I'll just add very quickly, as an urbanist and an urban historian,
yes.
I'm with you. So I'm not gonna hound you out of the room for that link of the polis and of the civic. I mean, these are all terms that that you actually write in here in another interesting passage. You know, are very much shaped by their urban setting, their urban site.
And Lawrence Mumford called the city a place of conversation.
Okay. Mumford, as weird as he is, it was an amazing thinker,
yes,
and an amazing stylist as well.
I think that our time is running, but one simple question, and what I like in your eloquence and in your, what I might call, phenomenological attempt at describing what it feels like to be a citizen, is the question perhaps of magnitude of 9/11, or question of scale, connected with what you stress in your analysis, like language games, and one that has always intrigued me, and you mentioned it in passing, but maybe just like that, is who called 9/11 an attack? You mentioned that it could have been called an act of terrorism. Attack suggests that if we are attacked, there is already some kind of war.
Mm-hmm.
So who did you... Did you have an answer to that? Because, for instance, I lived in Paris during a moment of regular bombings in the subway in 1995.
Right.
And it was the Algerian groups. Nobody called these an attack. They were acts of terrorism. People died, of course, not as many, but maybe 80, 50. I wonder about the question of the scale and, of course, the rhetorics of something like an attack. We are being attacked by somebody who is necessarily more than a few people, but has to be perhaps a country.
The vocabulary in which this was acted out in 2001 was slightly different than what you just said, but so I'll just rephrase it slightly to say, you know, there was a brief argument about should this be thought of on the criminal model or should it be thought of on the model of war? And the process of transforming the event into war actually took place fairly quickly. But you can see it because Bush immediately did not use the word war, and other people did not immediately use the war, and certain forces converged, and I try to give a kind of sketch account of that in the book. Certain forces converged to push Bush, these were, let's call them structural discursive forces, that pushed Bush into the, naming it as a war as, and as an act of war. And it is a structural fact, not a fact of his individual agency, that once he used the word war, that entailed or entrained a whole series of responses and styles of response and institutions of response and practices of response that drew it in that direction. So, I mean, you're absolutely right that that's a pivotal moment. And it's that moment that, so to speak, from the level of the surface drops a line down into this longer-term historical process of the development of civic war. We didn't talk at all about, but basically, I mean, I give an account that starts at the end of the Civil War and what happens through the course of the 19th century. And there's a whole, anyway, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of stuff there. But, and I was going to link that to it was a pretext to give a quick answer to one other thing that you said, and I forgot what it was. So.
Well, if I could just add something about this naming of it as war. If you remember in the 2004 election, there was a brief moment when Kerry tried to use the idea of organized, treating this more like a police concern, crime, organized crime, and it was, not only did it not catch on, but it was used very much against him.
No, it killed him.
Apropos of your point that by that time the analogy of war had already taken hold, so.
I wanted to. I know there may be more here. I wanted to say that it strikes me that Herbert Marcuse made the same kinds of arguments that you're making, and in the period of the 60s, because he was writing about the passive tolerance of the American public for state violence. Mm-hmm. Talked about an emergency and talked about the Cold War as a kind of using a vocabulary of emergency continuing, and also saying that, let's see, that what he wanted to, he felt, he was asking citizens to acknowledge their complicity and take some responsibility, so he had this kind of romantic idea of clearing a space for the subversive majority and all that. Mm-hmm. But what I'm sort of interested in this idea of structural discursiveness. And then you wanted to push it back to the Civil War. So is your argument that it occurred to me that there might be two models of your argument, and I wasn't quite sure which one you wanted to sign on to. One is that discursive structuralism strikes me a lot as a very mythological kind of notion, that there are certain stories that we throw up. And, I mean, emergency is a very useful organizing device for all social kind of activity. Although, you know, it's hard to reconstruct what social emergencies perhaps were before the Civil War, that's not the beginning of social emergencies. Mm-hmm. As a kind of all kinds of threats, disease. So is your argument ultimately about the way that an industrial state pushes against democratic, I mean, industrial states are places where there's a kind of movement of democracy, but also it's a place where large forces can be used against democracy. So is it from the Civil War forward as a function? Is this an industrial organization function? Or are you making the argument that that civic organization or political organization is itself always a struggle of unity and dissolution, and that we use these kinds of things that can be imagined as ruptures or discontinuities and so forth as the way of organizing chaos back and putting it back under?
Well, in a certain sense, it might be both, but in maybe ways that are not either as as deep as the first thing that you described would require as a form of analysis, or as pointed in exactly the same way as that you lay out the second one. But that game of projecting back to the, or keep perpetually, in a series of statements, asking again and again the question, so when do wars start? I do this about the Second World War as well, to illustrate the fact that Pearl Harbor was not the beginning of the war, and so forth and so on, just like, and so there's no punctual beginnings, and so forth and so on, and that these topics, discursive topics, are ways, as you aptly say, of organizing, not simply of ordering the world, but of organizing the relative relation between order and disorder, and that they're inserted into the public sphere in ways that are going to advance the projects of some people and block the projects of other people. The effects are not egalitarian, so to speak. But as far as on the question of the Civil War as a marker in the, there, I'll say just this much. There is, aside from this approach to historical thinking that I keep pointing back to, which kind of works backwards and in layers and so forth and so on, there is also a fairly straightforward historical narrative in one part of the book. And that's a part in which I react to, I don't state it so explicitly, but that I react against the fact that most people on the left reacted against the moves of the Bush administration by A, talking about the attack on rights, and then drawing a genealogy of the attacks on rights as perpetrated in moments of war in the past. And so, for example, somebody like Jeff Stone, the constitutional historian theorist, wrote a history of civil liberties in times of war. Now, there's a theoretical reason for my responding to that, and then there's the way I responded to it. The theoretical reason was that I actually don't think that politics is essentially about rights. I think it's about power. And that while it is the case that when your rights are attacked, you sure as hell better defend them, because you're really going to be in trouble if you don't. So I don't dismiss the importance of rights. But one of the characteristic things that happened in the during the Bush administration was that a whole lot of progress that was made in transforming politics into an associative process within civil society was pushed back regressively to the question of rights, which had been the major trend in the development of American political culture through, that was certainly through the Civil Rights Movement, but also before that as well, through the course of the 20th century, both as a matter of constitutional law, but also as a matter of political practice in civil society and so forth and so on. So the idea of operating political, I actually knew a guy named Roger Baldwin before he died, the founder of the ACLU, and you know, they invented a way of doing politics through rights claims in juridical institutions that then became a model for doing all sorts of politics, and this, in a way, the centerpiece of American politics up to the 60s. Then in the 60s, very briefly, but continuing after that in different forms of organization, associative politics gained some ground, rather than defending rights, but a kind of positive assertion of self-determination, self-government of communities, organization of communities, et cetera, et cetera. And that September 11, 2001 is in a certain respect an enormously regressive moment in that regard, and and enormously effective for the people who hate democracy, because they pushed the discourse back to the question of rights, and rightly so, because again, you've got to defend your rights. So what I do with respect to that genealogy, now using Stone as an example, is to say, okay, that's fine. These guys, like Stone and other people, it's helpful that they draw this punctuated history of what happens to civil liberties in times of war. And then I said, but that chronology is continuous. It's not a series of ruptures. It's not just what happens at, you know, with the habeas corpus cases in the Civil War, or the cases that led to Abrams and so forth and so on in the First World War and so forth, and that kind of thing. But that in that space between those punctuated moments, there's a whole lot of action that is relevant to what we're talking about here. And so I give the example of the use of emergency powers by the state in civil disorders, and specifically in labor disputes, and specifically in railroad strikes, to show that this long-term tendency in the development of executive power is not just about war powers, it's about emergency powers as they apply in civil society. And this is a point on which Obama actually is consistent with the tradition that we're talking about, because I talk about emergency powers, I mean, the bailout and X, Y, and Z. So there's the question that you raised, which is an open question for me as well. You know, there's a lot of ways to see these things as continuous from the Bush administration in ways that only, as far as I can tell, John Stewart is talking about. but the last piece of that is that in that continuous thread of history across those moments of what we recognize as wartime, you have a line, so to speak, of emergency powers and a line of war powers, and at certain moments they converge, certain moments they diverge, but that actually from the point of view of the citizen, unlike what Thomas Hobbes taught us, or other people like that taught us, it's not war that is fundamental, and then other kinds of powers derive from the fact of the war against all, of all against all. Actually, in my experience as a citizen, I experience war as an emergency, insofar as I experience it at all. And it's continuous with other kinds of emergencies. You know, I get pressed and pushed in all kinds of directions, this way and that way, and time speeds up for me. I better settle the question quick because it's an emergency. And in that situation, emergency is much more fundamental. And then the question becomes, so how is emergency rewritten and refigured and pushed through the symbolic construction or the symbolic figure of war? Anyway, there's a whole story there. So I'm so obsessed on that one line of development that I don't relate it specifically to the industrialization of society. But of course, the whole notion of total war and its relation to industrialism is one face of this story.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Thank you.